Chairman and comrades, the method I've used in presenting a sort of a historical review of the development of the labor movement and of the party is to show the interrelationship between both the objective and the subjective factor in the process. Not that they're always direct, but you can understand the development of a party only within the context of the objective situation in which the party functions. And you can understand then the process of splits, fusion, unification, which the party has undergone in the period since its inception, beginning with the first split from the Communist Party in 1928. Now, maybe we should review these so that you will have then some better grasp of the, I think, a question that was asked about, or rather, maybe it was a question that I posed that others have directed against us, most recently against Ward in a debate with a representative of science and society, that I paraphrase, if you're so smart, why aren't you rich? That is, if you had a correct program, why haven't you led a revolution in this country or in other countries throughout the world? And they tried to explain that there can be no revolution unless you have a revolutionary situation. That while the Revolutionary Party plays a decisive role in a revolutionary situation, it cannot make a revolution regardless of how correct you may be or how wise or brilliant your leadership may be. In 1934, as we discussed, there was an upsurge in the labor movement after the inauguration of Roosevelt and the beginning of the New Deal. And that resulted in the first fusion, the fusion between the Communist League of America and the American Workers' Party to establish the Workers' Party. Now, this fusion was brought about primarily because of the role played by the Communist League of America in the Minneapolis strike. As we discussed before, the American Workers' Party, or as it was known then and subsequently as the Musteeites, Mustee was one of the leaders, was a group that was primarily involved in the struggles of the workers for organization and of the unemployed workers. And one of their criticisms of the Communist League of America was that while we were all very competent theoreticians, and that when it came to arguing revolutionary theory, it was very difficult for them to stand up against us, but the big question mark that they placed over us, how good were you in the mass struggle? And that question was answered in Minneapolis when the Trotskyists there led the movement that organized the Teamsters and provided the basis for converting Minneapolis into a union town. It was one of the big open shop preserves of the employers in the 30s. And that satisfied at least the militants in the American Workers' Party. And of our competence in this area, and the fusion then was took place without too much difficulty. Sidney Hook left. He didn't go long into the Workers' Party, along with others, but Burnham, Musty, and a number of others came into the fused organization. Now, this led in turn to a split in 1935 with a grouping headed by Hugo Ohler, known in history as the Ohlerites, a sectarian grouping, which were very principled, and who insisted, of course, that every I be dotted and every T crossed before there could be any kind of a fusion with another organization. We were concerned only about establishing the basic principles of the movement and permitting time to develop differences, if such were to develop, and looked upon the fusion as a process of education. We had no fear about the competence of our comrades once they came into contact with the members of the AWP. The movement had been trained in combat against the Communist Party for a number of years. We had devoted practically all of our time as a faction in the Communist Party to intensive study of all of the problems of the revolution. And I might say we had some very qualified people, both in the ranks and the leadership, and we didn't see much danger in the AWP watering down our program. On the contrary, we felt every confidence that we'd be able to assimilate them and make Trotskyists out of the best of them, and we did. Now, this is a phenomena that you will witness, and we have witnessed in our party, but has been true ever since the beginning of the radical socialist movement. In fact, Engels, in the Marx-Engels correspondence, has a letter explaining why it is that at moments when the party is confronted with the necessity of making a turn, that you find resistance on the part of a section of the party, sometimes overt and sometimes covered. Comrades who become accustomed to a certain routine, who draw back from making a necessary change in their whole method of functioning and a whole view of the development, and respond often by sectarian insistence upon living up to every principle that they can cull from the text of whatever books they've read that have justified the existence of the party in a previous period in order to oppose a change that the party has made. If you're interested, you should look through the correspondence. You'll find the letter there, among other letters on this question, by Engels especially, who played a very active role in the development of the German social democracy. So far as the building of the party is concerned, probably Engels wrote more prolifically on it than Marx, who was more concerned with the theoretical aspects of the problem. They resisted and conducted a big struggle, and in the course of the fight, split from the party. And like all such groups, after they split, they had a split. Two, three splits, I think. I think their headquarters was here in Chicago. They published a paper called The Fighting Worker. And they continued for a very long time. That's another phenomenon in the radical movement, that it's the sectarian groups can go on indefinitely, it seems, for many, many years, because what happens in the outside world has no effect upon their reactions whatever. They continue, if reality doesn't conform to their theory, so much the worse for reality. And when you get that kind of a grouping together, you can go on indefinitely repeating the same formulae and blaming everything that goes wrong on what's happening outside. and not on your theory and practice. In 1936, we have the rise of the CIO, a continuation of the upsurge, the development of a left wing in the Socialist Party as an outgrowth of the effect of the victory of Hitler in Germany, the reaction, rather, to the victory of Hitler in Germany, and the beginning of the Spanish Civil War. It was under those circumstances that we executed an entry in order to fuse with the left wing of the Socialist Party and to reinforce the very small group, the very small cadre of the Socialist Workers' Party. These are all methods that the party has undertaken to build the party. All detours, if you remember, from the original objective and perspective when the party split from the, that is when we abandoned functioning as a faction and announced our beginning to function as an independent party and beginning to recruit by ones and twos. There's no great merit in recruiting by ones and twos unless you're compelled to do so. Where you see other elements or groupings developing in your direction, if you're alive to the necessity and the dialectic of building a party, you at least go halfway and three-quarters of the way, and this time we went all the way into the Socialist Party in order to fuse with this developing left wing. In 1938, you remember, by that time, the Spanish Civil War was on the verge of being defeated, if it had not been defeated, by 1938. I can't remember when Madrid fell. But by that time, it was obvious that the Spanish Civil War was going to be defeated because of the false policy of both the Stalinists and the Republicans and the Socialists. And there was a certain reaction set in. Our struggle in the Socialist Party against the centrists and the right wing led to a split from the Socialist Party when they wanted to impose upon us the Leninist concept of democratic centralism. On the left wing, not on the right wing. We said that's not quite a Leninist concept, and we refused to submit to discipline which would have compelled us to violate principle. The question of coalitionism, of people's frontism, is to us a principle, and under no circumstances can it be violated for any kind of tactic, even that so important a one of acquiring additional forces for the party. And it resulted in the formation of the Socialist Workers' Party in 1938 and of the founding Congress of the Fourth International. I stated then that in 1938, at the founding convention of the party, there began the debate on the question of the class character of the Soviet Union. If I remember the positions presented in that convention, I think they ranged over the entire political spectrum. We had a tendency that characterized the Soviet Union as a fascist state. We had a tendency that characterized the Soviet Union as bureaucratic collectivism. We had our traditional worker state position. We had the tendency, I think, characterizers didn't know what the hell it was, and so forth and so on. It was a very lively convention. All views were given a complete, full, and adequate hearing. It was a forerunner of the fight that took place in 1939. But it wasn't long after the party had been established in 1938 that the war broke out in 1939 with the Hitler-Stalin pact. This had a tremendous impact, especially upon petty bourgeois radical circles in this country. Hitler, justifiably, was hated, reviled, not only by radicals, but by all people who had any sense of justice. The atrocities committed by Hitler, especially upon the Jewish people, a large part of the radical movement were Jewish, and much of the periphery around the party. The impact of this public opinion against the Hitler-Stalin pact, and especially after the invasion of Finland, infected a substantial section not only of the party but of the party leadership, and led to one of the most fundamental discussions in the whole history of the party, covering every aspect of Marxist theory, philosophy, sociology, politics, strategy, and tactics, organization. Two books written on this period in defense of Marxism and the struggle for a proletarian party are two of our classics, documenting the issues, both political theory and theoretical, political theoretical, or they say ideological, philosophical, and organizational, that arose in the course of this dispute, and was a very deep-going split. That is, the Shachmanite minority took some 40% of the party. At the beginning of the fight, they had a majority of the political committee. They were the editors of the paper and of the magazine, and they were head of the militant business administration and of pioneer publishers. They represented almost half of the party, if not more, at the beginning of the struggle, and 40%. At the time of the split. This was the effect that the war had upon the party and the general atmosphere of revulsion against the method, the way the Stalinist, cynical method, the way in which the Stalinist not only joined with Hitler in their pact, but the partition of Poland and the invasion of Finland and the absorption of Bessarabia and some of the other, the three, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, some of the border countries by force and invasion of the Red Army. Now, I can't possibly go into all of the questions involved in this dispute. You could spend an hour or more on any one of them, on the dispute over dialectical materialism, on the many of the political questions that were corollary to the main question of the class character of the state. I will just say that briefly, the character of the opposition assumed that of a combination. We characterize it as an unprincipled combination because the three major leaders of the opposition held different views on what we considered the central issue in the dispute, the class character of the Soviet Union. Majority held our traditional position of unconditional defense of the Soviet Union against imperialist attack. The Abern Wing, the leaders of the minority of the opposition were Martin Abern, one of the founders of the party, Shachman, another one of the founders of the party, and Burnham, who had come into the Workers' Party through the American Workers' Party. I've been one of the leaders with Musty of the American Workers' Party, and who then became one of the leaders of the Workers' Party. Abern's position was held that the majority concept was correct, that it was the Soviet Union was a workers' state. Burnham first advanced the concept of bureaucratic collectivism. There was a new form of state, and that this bureaucratic collectivism would be the next stage in the development between capitalism and socialism. But the development would take the course of going from capitalism through bureaucratic collectivism and then into socialism, as I remembered at that time. He later modified it when he split not only from the Workers' Party, but from the Shachmanites, and wrote his book called The Managerial Revolution, in which then he made an identity with fascism, between fascism and Stalinism. He said both are forms of bureaucratic collectivism, and we have to oppose both. I think he was one of the original Third Camp advocates. Shachman refused to take a position. He says this is not important, that what is important is the reality of living events. Well, how do you determine the reality of living events if you don't begin, as Marxists do, in the struggle between states, on first determining what the character of the state is that's involved in a conflict? We don't determine our attitude toward questions of war without first determining what the character of the state is involved in this war. And that was our traditional position, not ours, but the position of Marxists from the very beginning. But he refused to commit himself on this question. In fact, under his pressure, Burnham withdrew his resolution on bureaucratic collectivism, and therefore we had before us not a counterposition on what was the major political question, but a block on the organization question. They said the important question was the regime. It was a very bad regime. They called it bureaucratic conservatism. It was conservative because we insisted upon clinging to our old ideas, which had been negated and outworn by these new developments. And the block was held together by the cement of agreement on the question of the regime. Now, we all learned a very important lesson then about such combinations, because the question immediately arises. If, for example, the combination had a majority in the party, took over a majority, and took over the leadership of the party, what would be the position of the party? Would it be Abrams' position of workers' state? Would it be Shachman's position of no position, that is the reality of living events? Or would then Burnham take his position out of his briefcase, and would the position then be bureaucratic collectivism? And it reinforced once again that departing from principled politics can lead only to disintegration. Trotsky pointed out, he says, well, you may have a lot of justified criticisms over the regime. He says, but as Marxists, we determine our attitude towards the regime by the political line it carries out. A good regime is a regime that carries out what we consider a correct political line. And a bad regime, even if they were made up of people who all loved their mothers and went to church and knelt down before three times on Sunday, would still be a bad regime, because the political line would be incorrect, and therefore it could only lead to defeat. And the determination of the regime then, in the last analysis, is what are its politics? And I'll show you as we go on how this same question played a role in the subsequent factional disputes in the party in different forms. Now, that doesn't mean that there can't be individuals in a regime who are rude or arrogant or incompetent, but that's not decisive, or even a little bureaucratic. But that is not decisive in a struggle over political principle. When questions involving political principle are in dispute, those are the decisive questions, and those are the deciding questions, and the so-called organization questions always subordinate to it. Throughout the period of the war, that is, I might say that when the split occurred, the opposition took the name of Workers' Party, and the name of their paper became Labor Action. Remember the paper that we published in San Francisco when we entered the Socialist Party? And they stole the magazine from us, and then we published the magazine under the name of Fourth International. Previously it had been New International. Burnham never went along with them. After the split from the Socialist Workers' Party, he announced he was splitting from the Shackmanites because he had a principled opposition view on the whole question of Marxist philosophy, sociology, and politics, including the question of bureaucratic collectivism. The Workers' Party, the Shackmanite Workers' Party, didn't adopt a position on this question until 1941, at their first convention following the split in 1940. They introduced and adopted a resolution, and bureaucratic collectivism became the line of the Workers' Party, Third Campism. Throughout the period of the war, and they entered into competition with us as an opponent organization. They published a paper. They ran candidates against us. They were going to show us how to go about building a party. They had all the intellectuals. They had all the writers. They had all the thinkers. And they were going to show us how to do it. But in the end, it was the political line that prevailed. We had some few people left who could put out a paper and a magazine and who knew something about running a party. And we continued to function and to survive while the Shackmanites ended up several years ago back into the Socialist Party, where they now constitute one of the sections of the right wing of that organization. Gave up their independent organizational existence. Because they were cursed from the very beginning. They were cursed from the very beginning by the kind of struggle that they conducted inside of the Socialist Workers' Party on the so-called organization question. And from the very beginning, the Workers' Party was cursed with factional permanent faction around the disputed political questions that had arisen in the course of our discussion. Johnson with his Workers' Party position, you had bureaucratic collectivism, you had a workers' state position. And on a whole series of other questions, they had from the very beginning a combination of factions, never a centralized Bolshevik party that had a unified, homogeneous political line. One of the inevitable outcomes of unprincipled combinationism. In 1940, our comrades were indicted on the Smith Act, and the Smith Act case became one of our major campaigns for the whole first period of the war, up until the comrades went to prison in the latter part of 1943, beginning of 1944. And we were able to arouse a considerable support in many sections of the labor movement. Many very important unions, mass organizations rallied to the support of our comrades, despite the organized attempt on the part of the Communist Party to sabotage and to slander the Minneapolis defendants and prevent, where they had any influence over the union, any support to our case, for which they paid heavily when their leaders were indicted under the same act a few years later after the war and were sent to prison. And we were never permitted to forget many of the organizations that they went to for support reminded them of the role that they played when the leaders of the SWP and the Minneapolis truck drivers were indicted under the Smith Act. They never got the kind of support we got, and one of the reasons for it was their conduct during the first Minneapolis Smith Act trial. In the post-war period, that is the period 1945-46, as we discussed, there was another turn, another upsurge, a big strike wave. And it reflected itself in the party by the necessity of making another turn. That is a turn to the mass, a turn to the mass movement. And your sub-drive of yesterday reminded me of the activity of the party during the 45-46. If you'll read back in the back issues of the Militant, you will see that in that period, the quota for our sub-drives were around 22,000 subs for a three-month campaign. We were selling 25-cent introductory subs, but I don't think that was the difference. There was the beginning of a radicalization, And again, in that period, most of the subs were sold to Negro people. The greatest response were in the Negro areas. In fact, in New York, I was organizer of the New York local at the time. Through the sub campaigns and a subsequent study group that we organized in local, we built a Harlem branch of about 100 people in 1946. Now the peculiarity was that there was not the kind of movement there is today among the Negro people. It was part of the general radicalization reaction of the working class against the restrictions imposed upon them by the war that brought them in. Now one thing we could not do, we could not hold them, because at the beginning of the Cold War, a reaction set in. The beginning of the long period of prosperity reaction. And we could not give them action. We were a small group, primarily a propaganda group. A group that is attempting to gather together a cadre of revolutionary socialists to build an advance guard capable of appealing to more advanced workers, but not capable of substituting for the institutions and organizations of action which then existed. The situation now is much different. That is, now you have a radicalization among the Negro people. You have a big movement fighting militant movement. The working class is passive. And unfortunately, on this question, by and large, reactionary. Now, at one time or another, there's going to be a conjuncture of a radicalization of the working class together with a radicalized Negro mass, and then you will be in a pre-revolutionary situation. And sell a lot more subs than you did yesterday, I'm sure. Not only that, we'll grow to the point where we'll begin to actually lead mass action of a militant character, either directly or through our participation in the action organization. Now, here again, there took place an internal struggle in the party. This time it had a twofold character. Strangely enough, the radicalization gave rise to a proposal for a reunification of the Socialist Workers' Party and the Workers' Party, the Shachmanites, on the part of a number of people in our party and a number of people in the Workers' Party. We proceeded in good faith to welcome any step in discussion of the possibility for a reunification, and found that instead of having been advanced seriously, it was advanced as a maneuver in an attempt to split off a grouping in the Socialist Workers' Party. Now, unity maneuvers are very bad things to fool around with. And when you do, you usually get burnt. There's one thing you've got to be serious about, it's this question of unification. You can't maneuver with the question of unity, as they found out. We entered into the unification discussion in good faith, and we found that, as I say, discovered with the unity maneuver by virtue of the reaction that occurred when the discussion began. Now, when you go into a unity discussion with a tendency that you feel is coming closer to your views, and you feel that there is a possible area sufficiently wide in agreement to establish a unified organization, there are certain preliminary signs which indicate whether or not you are serious. In your public press, for example, you don't begin attacking the other organization that you're discussing unity with. You don't begin vilifying the leadership. You don't begin digging up all kinds of past disagreements, which are exaggerated, and playing down the areas in which you have agreement. And this is what we began to see in labor action. Well, when we got into the discussion of unification, they sharpened up their attack upon the Socialist Workers' Party. So we said, well, this is not a serious unity proposal. This is a unity maneuver. And we've done a little maneuvering ourselves in the past on one question or another. We've been around for a while, so we said, all right, if this is what you want, if this is sort of a game you want to play, we'll play. The result was that a few people in the SWP who had become frustrated by the fact that the Second World War did not result in a revolution throughout Europe and the world, and who began to have some doubts about the ability of the American working class to make a revolution, and found this unity maneuver a way of leaving the movement, split from the party. One, Felix Morrow, was expelled from the party for disloyalty, for meeting with the Shachmanites behind the back of the party leadership. And at the same time, a whole group from the Workers' Party who were serious about reunification, the Johnson group, a much larger group, split from them and came over and joined the Socialist Workers' Party. That is, they genuinely wanted unity. And they were outraged by this unity maneuver. And they expressed their dissatisfaction by carrying through the unification by a split in the Workers' Party. So you had a two-way split and a two-way unification. The Johnsonites came over to the Socialist Workers' Party. Morrow and a little group went over to the Workers' Party, and from then on we turned our backs on the Shachmanites, had nothing more to do with them except consider them an opponent organization in which we engaged in political struggle. Now, in the period from 1946, the beginning of the Cold War, there developed the turn on the part of the Stalin and Moscow, which resulted in the overthrowing of the coalition governments established immediately after the war in Czechoslovakia, Poland, Romania, Bulgaria, Albania, the East European countries. Now, after the end of the war, coalition governments had been established in these areas as part of the agreement between the Allied powers on a division between the areas of influence which each would exercise throughout the entire world. These coalition governments were completely artificial, because the ruling class didn't exist as a force. In many of the countries, the Red Army was the real force in the country, but as a vehicle through which future bargaining could be conducted with the erstwhile allies, the United States and Great Britain and France. Well, when with the Cold War, there was no bargaining or no room for bargaining, and as a reaction to the Cold War, the Stalinists proceeded to destroy these coalition governments and to establish in these countries to nationalize the production, establish basically the foundations of workers' states in these areas. In 1949 came the big revolutionary victory in China, led by the Chinese Communist Party, which toppled the Chiang Kai-shek regime. And there again, after playing around with the idea of coalition for a few years, with the outbreak of the Korean War, found that they were compelled to move towards nationalization of basic industry, finance, and to eliminate, to all intents and purposes, any real representation from the bourgeois sections of society in China. In 1950-52, the Korean War, and concomitant with it, a witch hunt, the beginning of McCarthyism. And all of this had the effect upon a section of our party, known as the Cochranites, and on the leadership of the Fourth International, under the leadership of Pablo, began to develop illusions about the possibility of reforming Stalinism and of Stalinism playing a progressive revolutionary role in leading revolutionary movements throughout Europe and the world for the overthrow of capitalism and the establishment of worker states and socialism. And if that was the case, then the question was raised, what function would the Fourth International and its section play? Combined with this was the prediction that war was imminent. In fact, one of the leaders of the Cochranite group in our party, Harry Franco, predicted in the Militant, you'll find it in his article in the Militant, he actually predicted the month I think it was June 1953, he said, was when the World War III would break out. And that this would not provide time enough to build independent revolutionary parties. And as a consequence of the war and the ultimate victory of the Soviet bloc in the war, that the revolutionary overturns would take place under the leadership of the communist parties throughout the world under the aegis of Moscow and the Kremlin. Now, here again was expressed, I think, in one very winged phrase by George Clark, one of the top leaders of the Cochranite groups, the clue to what was bothering this tendency. When he made the statement that, in his opinion, it would take an atom bomb, the way he said it, the American working class would have to be hit on the head with an atom bomb before it woke up. They had lost all confidence, all faith in the ability of the American working class to perform its historical role as the leader of the American Revolution, and therefore began to turn to look in some other direction for an alternative force that would substitute for what we consider the decisive factor and force in any revolutionary overturn, any revolutionary transformation, the organized working class. The Cochrane Group was also an unprincipled combination. The Clark wing supported this view that Stalinism was the wave of the future. The Cochrane wing supported the concept that the American labor bureaucracy was so all-powerful, astute, was so experienced with faction fights against the radicals in the labor movement that there was no possibility of repeating the experience of the working class of the 30s, where a new leadership came up out of the ranks in many instances where the old leadership was overthrown. And a new leadership was established over a new section, a more dynamic section of the American working class movement. And that therefore it was necessary for the party to convert itself into a propaganda group. We discussed before, to quit acting like a party, to put out a little magazine. In other words, the role and function of the party was to influence the progressive wing of the labor bureaucracy, you see, to be a little more forward thinking and acting than they would under ordinary circumstances. And many of them now have made their peace with the labor bureaucracy and are officials of one kind or another in a number of the local unions in which they've been active. Again, concluded that there was no possibility for the American working class to make its revolution and began looking in other directions for some substitute force to do it for him. It was a mood that arose out of a period of very deep reaction, if you remember the McCarthyite period. It arose a mood out of the fact that the American working class, by and large, were passive, that the period of prosperity following the war, especially following with Korea at the end of 49, in a period of prosperity. And they were not responsive to radical socialist ideas. And so they proceeded to write them off. Many tendencies in the world movement have done likewise. C. Wright Mills with his concept of an elite, which would lead the revolutionary transformation as a substitute for working classes. Concluding that the American working class was incapable of performing its historic role, and therefore it was necessary to find a substitute. I might say that this was also the view of one of our people in Cuba. In 1949 or 50, I can't remember. I was sailing on a ship between New York and Havana, and I was in contact with some of our, we have a few people in Havana at the time. It was not under the regime of Batista. Prio Sicaris was in power then. Batista came later, if you remember, when he ousted Sicaris by a military coup. I can't remember what year it was, 52, 53, yeah, a year or so later. And I heard from them exactly the same thing. The only possibility for Cuba to make its revolution would be to get hit on the head with an atom bomb. That is, through the intervention of a revolution in which the Stalinists would provide the leadership, through an invasion by the Red Army and the overthrow of capitalism. Eight years later, you had the Cuban Revolution led by Castro and the 26th of July movement. Now, this combination between the supporters of these two antagonistic bureaucracies didn't last very long, because from the beginning they had this fatal flaw. There was a divergence in their political line. There was a contradiction between looking towards the American labor bureaucracy, which acted as a labor lieutenants for the American working, for the American capitalist class, for Washington and the State Department, and were carrying on a Cold War, which they hotted up occasionally, and looking to the Kremlin, to Moscow, for leadership in the revolutionary struggle. And it was not long before they split. They published the American Socialist for a while, and I think somebody remarked, rather paraphrased, what their last editorial statement was when they gave up publication, and they are no longer around. A split in a time of reaction. Or you can see there's sort of a pattern. As I say, I don't want you to interpret what I say to conclude that there's always a direct relationship. But usually you will find in the development of the Revolutionary Party, which is operates in a very hostile environment up until the period of the pre-revolutionary period, it becomes a mass movement, subjected to the pressures of this environment, will react either to a period of reaction or advance in the mass movement in which it lives, breathes, operates, and which sustains it. In 1956, there took place a very historic event, the 20th World Congress, and Khrushchev's de-Stalinization speech, which shook up the entire communist movement throughout the world. There began a big debate within this movement and in the American Communist Party, and we decided to intervene because we had something to say about many of these questions. Certainly the question of de-Stalinization, of what Stalinism had done, what Stalinism meant for both the Soviet Union and for the world working class. In the course of this debate, many of our old friends turned up, and some of them did yeoman service. Musty, for example. Remember Musty, with whom we fused in 1935? He turned up as the head of the American Forum for Socialist Education, which was intended to provide a forum for all radicals to discuss the questions, especially those questions raised by Khrushchev in his 20th Congress speech. Very fine. We found Bartel, Clark, and others of the Cochranite group inside of the American Forum for Socialist Education, and then later in the electoral bloc that we cemented in New York, that ran candidates in the New York election, I think, of 1958, under the United Independent Socialist Party ticket. And they say some of them did yeoman service in providing a link between the elements inside of the Communist Party who had been shocked into at least a willingness to listen to others, and even some who were friendly and who joined the party. It was our so-called regroupment period. Many of you may here remember this period that we went through, 1956 to 1958, when we projected the idea of a regroupment on the basis, again, of a program, full and free discussion among all radical tendencies in order to arrive at a conclusion new organization, if necessary, or of realignments of existing organizations. We didn't know when this movement in the CP developed. I don't think anybody knew, and then no one could know, whether or not this was the harbinger of the development of a centrist tendency. The Gates wing of the Communist Party, who fought against, who embraced the de-Stalinization and fought against the hard-nosed section of Foster, Ben Davis, and some of the others, had a majority of the party. It was altogether possible that if a split occurred in the party, that is, if they were serious enough about advancing their views on the question of the type of a movement that was necessary to meet the needs of the American working class, it was possible that such a development, either to split as a majority or a minority, would confront us with a new formation of a centrist character. Of a centrist character, because inevitably it means they'd be moving away from Stalinism and towards, at least a half a step, if no further, towards a reconsideration of revolutionary socialism. And there, once again, we felt it necessary to take a detour. We didn't turn our backs on it. We say a plague on these people. They're getting what they deserve, and they're not worth anything. No. We said, well, we'll try and get whatever is viable that there is there. If there is a split, then we'll discuss with them a program for reunification in a new party. If there was a majority there who had learned anything from their experience and were willing to accept a revolutionary program, there was no need for two competing organizations. Our concept is that there can only be one revolutionary socialist party, unless you have cliques. Why would you need two? If you have two parties who agree programmatically on all the principal questions, there's no justification for the existence of separate organizations, unless you have cults or cliques. We've had that in many parts of the world. In South America, in some of the countries, you have three or four parties who call themselves Trotskyist parties. And in some cases, or you had, you don't anymore, fortunately, And some places it was impossible to tell even with a microscope what the distinction was between them. And the only differences were hostility and friction between some of the top, the leading people of these various groupings. But that's not our concept of politics. We're out to build a party. You build a party on the basis of a political line, of political principles that have been tested over and over again in the whole history of the movement, on the basis of a theory, the theory of Marxist-Leninism, Marxism-Leninism, the theory of revolutionary socialism. And if there is a party that even begins to approximate our approach, that kind of an organization, then if they won't come to us, we'll go to them every time. We're not proud. The only thing that we aspire to do is to build an effective party that's capable of leading the American working class to a successful revolutionary overthrow of capitalism. And if there's any group of workers that wants to join with us or is even moving in our direction, we'll always go halfway and more to meet them. Well, this also developed a struggle with another little sectarian grouping, the Marxists. And we were accused of selling out to Satan, Lucifer, and what is the name of this millionaire in New York? Satan, Lucifer, and Corliss Lamont. Of abandoning our program, of jettisoning our principles, of throwing overboard the whole tradition of Trotskyism, etc., etc., ad nauseum. There again, we had no, as I say, we had no fear. Confronted with the kind of a membership that we have, who are trained Marxists, in our opinion, to put them up against people who have been trained in the Stalinist school on the question of theory, we had no fear. Because not only was the question of theory, not only was it a question of theory, but we felt that the course of events were helping us, were moving in our direction. And we were coming out of the period of reaction and was beginning to move in the other direction. That Stalinism itself, one of the bulwarks of world reaction, was being shattered. The monolith was being shattered. And that both objective and subjective factors were entirely in order. Well, nothing developed, actually. The Gates Group just disintegrated. The corruption of the Stalinist school had bitten too deep. And instead of conducting a struggle for power as a majority, they kept horsing around until they were cut to pieces. Until most of their people voted with their feet. They just got up and walked out. They left. And when they found that they were a minority, then they got the kind of democracy that the Communist Party is noted for. They got booted out, what was left of them. And that was the end of the Grey Gates Group. True, a number of individuals, a number of people came over and joined the Socialist Workers' Party, some of them in the party doing very good work in positions of leadership in the party. Worker communists who had been misled by Stalinism had been their eyes opened up by the Khrushchev speech and the consequences that follow, and contacted us and are now Trotskyists and are helping us to build the party. In 1959 was the Cuban Revolution. That again gave a great impetus to revolutionary currents throughout the entire world, especially to us here in this country, to have a revolution just a few miles off the shore of in this hemisphere, the first revolution of its kind in history, gave a tremendous impetus to the work of the party. I believe primarily its success one of the greatest factors to which we can attribute the success of building a youth movement was the Cuban Revolution. Many of the young students who came to us on the basis, first, of being awakened by the Cuban Revolution. Many of them went to Cuba and saw and were inspired by what they saw in Cuba. It's for good reason that they maintain a travel ban and prevent people from going down there and seeing with their own eyes what's occurring. They could never continue to fool the American people if they were only put down there and see for themselves what has happened. And so they're tightening up more and more the restrictions on people going there. But in the period when people could go there, they say many, many young people came to us on the basis of the inspiration provided by the Cuban Revolution and the position of the party as the most militant defenders and supporters of revolution. Now, in the course of all this, these developments, with the turn that began even before 1956, but primarily 1956 with the Hungarian Revolution, the Polish uprising, we began to note that the split that had taken place in the Fourth International in 1953, when the Cochranites split here, and the split occurred with the Pablo group on an international mission on Poland, on the Chinese Revolution, and then when they did on the Cuban Revolution, we felt, well, we have to begin to explore the possibility of a reunification of the international movement. Because again, once we find that we are in political agreement, then there is no real barrier or no justification for the existence of separate organizations, either in the international arena or in the local areas in which we work. That's our criteria. We said we have to begin to explore, to examine, to discuss this question of reunification. In fact, it was in 1957 that the party first made its proposal for a parity committee to open up such a discussion. But because of conflicts that we had, especially with the British, who were dragging the feet, it took a period of some 1957 to 1963. Before the reunification was consummated. And even then, against the resistance of the British and a South American grouping under the leadership of the Posadas tenants. The reunification has a strictly principled character. That doesn't mean that there are no differences. We don't have that concept of a party or an international. We believe in the kind of a party that Lenin and Trotsky aspire to build. That is a democratic centralist party that provides both the means and the right for minorities to exist and present their point of view on every and all questions. We don't have the concept of a monolithic party. That's the Stalinist concept. You know, they have a very peculiar interpretation of what Lenin meant by democratic centralism. They perverted the concept of democratic centralism to mean that the minority must agree with the majority. All democratic centralism means is that the minority accepts the decision of the majority. It's a psychological impossibility to expunge from your own mind, say, views with which you hold, just because you find yourself in a minority, and be compelled then either to undergo a process of thought remolding in order to justify your continued existence as a member of a party. I said that's a caricature of democratic centralism. Lenin never meant that. Even in the most difficult times of the Civil War, groupings and factions existed. It was only at the 10th Congress that they temporarily, because the the question of victory or defeat hung in the balance that temporarily they suspended faction organizations in the Bolshevik Party, never intended as a permanent. And they stated it was with great trepidation that they took this measure and stated it was only a very temporary expedient. And just as soon as they're past this very dangerous critical point that the norms of democratic centralism would prevail in the party. We don't have that concept. Sure, there are differences. Not principal differences, no. But there will always be differences in a democratic party. And we've got to create a kind of an atmosphere in which those differences can be discussed and debated and a decision made. And when a decision made, it's the decision of the majority that's carried out, that's all. And the minority abides by that decision until the party decides at an appropriate time to reopen the discussion, usually in a pre-convention period, at which time the question is again discussed, debated, and decided. The majority is not always right. The only real test is the history itself. Decides whether a majority or minority is right or not. And if politics has this great advantage over religion, it doesn't take very long for events to determine. Well, you can argue from now till doomsday how many angels can dance on the point of a needle. There's no way of deciding it. Not through historical experience, or not through any visible, not through your senses. But in politics, experience very quickly decides who is right and who is wrong. And that's why this concept of a combat party, based upon the principle of democratic and practice of democratic centralism, proves to be such a potent vehicle for revolutionary change in Russia. And it's the only kind of party that can conquer power in any of the advanced industrial countries. No other kind of party is going to do it. You've got to have revolutionists. You can't have robots. Robots can't make any revolution in the advanced industrial countries. Those who are prepared to take orders from above without thinking for themselves, you're going to have a self-thinking, self-acting party, trained and able to respond to events, and able to occupy positions of leadership with responsibility and to think and act for themselves. And that's the kind of a party we want to have, and that's the kind of a membership we're trying to train. I think we've done a pretty good job. Questions? Well, it's a very difficult question to answer. Very difficult question to answer. It would have to be the Negroes that would make the decision, not us, in that event. See, maybe we would feel that there'd be no justification for it. But it would be not up to us to decide. A lot depends upon what happens in the struggle itself, you see. That is, if in the course of the struggle, the reaction becomes intense and there's an attempt at suppression of the Negro movement, at, say, even a fascist development, then the tendency for separation is going to grow. And a reunification will take place only after the successful conquest of power, when a successful revolutionary workers, or a workers' state, then would have to tell the Negro people, you decide for yourself what you want. We want integration. If you're suspicious of whites because of your experience, then you have the right to separate if you want to. And we feel that separation, in that sort of separation, will lead to integration when you have regained your confidence that this is a different kind of government than you've had experience with before. You see, you're confronted somewhat with the same problem now. Negroes have lost confidence in whites. They have many bad experiences with white organizations. They've been sold out too many times. And they feel that this is primarily their fight, and they're the only ones that they're confident will carry it through to the end. If I remember Clegg's article in the International Socialist Review. You see, to Clegg it says that, how did he put it? We don't know what station you're going to get off at, you see. All we know is the Negro's got to go all the way, you see. And that's the kind of an organization they want, and justifiably. That's why we support it. Now, in the course of the struggle, again, a different variant. If we're able to oust these labor skates who actually act as a front for the white supremacists, a tail to the Democratic Party, and if the revolutionary socialists are able to take over leadership of the trade union movement, of the mass movement, then it would be possible to demonstrate in action to the Negroes that there has a change taken place, you see. And in the course of common action to achieve the struggle for freedom and equality, they, Negroes themselves, may decide membership in a common organization is sufficient to carry them through to the end. See, it will depend upon the struggle. All we can say now is that the struggle of the Negroes for freedom now can only accelerate the process of political consciousness on the part of the working class. It's going to compel the working class to act, and act against the fakers if necessary, and I think it will be necessary. Under the conditions of the present size and of the SWP, well, I would say in every case we would withdraw our candidates and support the Freedom Now candidate, as we would with a Labor Party candidate. We wouldn't run against if you had an independent Labor Party candidate. Under present circumstances, I'm talking about now. I'm not talking about in a revolutionary situation where the question of power is posed. We would withdraw our candidate and give support. We'd give critical support to a Labor Party candidate or to a Freedom Now candidate. Because otherwise our whole demand our whole fight for the Labor Party, that is, for the workers to break with the Democratic coalition, Labor Democratic coalition, and to form their own independent political party would be meaningless if we then entered as competitors with them in electoral activity. It would have no meaning. We would use our participation in electoral activity under those circumstances to give it a programmatic character. That's what I mean by critical support. We say that the Labor candidate should advocate such and such measure, 30-hour week, the appropriation of all war funds for the use of the unemployed. Those slogans, those transition slogans from our program, we would advance as demands which we felt that the Labor Party candidate, if elected, or in the process of election, should embrace, you see. But we wouldn't compete with them. A more ticklish situation may develop, however, say where you had a Labor candidate running against a Freedom Now candidate. Under those circumstances, we would advocate support to the Freedom Now candidate and advocate that the Labor candidate support the Freedom Now candidate. We're strong believers in compensatory action. We've got a lot to atone for the treatment of the Negroes for 100 years in this country. Well, I don't know what you mean by integrated. You see, the whole question is, I know, the whole question is, shall the Negroes wait till the white workers are ready to move on the political arena through their independent political organization? See, we begin with the premise, and I think it's unassailable, that this is essentially a political struggle, both for the white workers as well as for the Negroes. And you cannot conduct an effective political struggle for either freedom now or for unemployment or for the rights of white working class by supporting candidates of the capitalist class, that is the capitalist parties who represent the employers. You cannot do it. Negroes could never win, but token demands and concessions, so long as they remain tied to the Democratic Party, because the Democratic Party is the political instrument, especially in the South, through which Jim Crow is maintained, perpetuated, and enforced. How can you do it? We're against this concept of gradual. We're against the concept the Negroes have got to wait, you see. That's the worst. I don't say that you hold this concept. I say implicit in this. I know there are those who say, well, the workers also are unemployed, and the workers are the decisive force, and the Negroes are only 10% of the population. Certainly they can't achieve the revolution in this country without allies. The only way they're going to get allies, effective allies, is to continue to act militantly in their struggles for even partial concessions, and to go forward from there to the organization of a political instrument which will challenge the white power structure. You see. Now, it's this that's going to pound, in my opinion, pound into the heads of the white workers the necessity of taking similar action if they're going to solve any one of their elementary demands. You can't even have a strike now without intervention from Washington. What has been the experience in the past period? Any strike of any significance. Every time there's a strike, the first thing you have is one of the Kennedy's sharpshooters, Willard Wirtz or somebody else, coming in and demanding settlement on the basis of terms, which would compromise away which they feel are fundamental demands, or threatening them with congressional action unless they accept mediation by the government. Isn't that the situation of the railroad workers today? Every commission appointed by Kennedy, without exception, has found for the railroads and against the union on the question of most concern to them, the question of the work rules. So they're opposed to this. And they want to use the only effective weapon they have, the strike weapon. So what happens? Kennedy calls upon Congress to pass special legislation to compel them to accept an arbitration award. Now, what kind of an arbitration award do you think they're going to get on the basis of the record? The problems confronted by these people, both in the case of Cuba and the underdeveloped country, and in the case of the workers in the worker states, there can be no solution to their problem. They cannot even accomplish their democratic tasks, you see, under the leadership of the bourgeoisie. And you're learning it both in a positive and a negative way. Negatively, I'd say a case like India. They're the so-called middle way. Well, they're going from bad to worse. You can't solve the problem of India on a capitalist basis. India cannot become a modern industrial country under the circumstances in which its difficulties increase from year to year. They're trying it that way. It's not going to work. And already, as I say, there's tremendous resentment and opposition and rebellion, and it must, either that or your program is wrong, you see. And then you have to ask yourself, has history developed in accord with our programmatic concept, especially the permanent revolution and the transition program? Does it conform to the needs of the workers of the advanced countries, the worker states, and of the underdeveloped countries?